This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And Layla, I might take a moment to mention that there are now three ways to get us questions. One is if you tune into our weekly broadcast, you can listen live via a convenient link at drhoffman.com, or if you're in the range of our AM stations and a couple of FM stations, you can listen live, and the number is 888-302-3684. You can call in during our program Saturdays from noon to 2 p.m. Eastern time, and you can speak to me on the air. Failing that, you can also go to drhoffman.com, and there's this this little black bar on the right side of our homepage. And when I saw it, I said, what the heck is that? I didn't even know what it was yet. And then I clicked on it, and it enables you to record an audio message with either a comment or a question that we can then answer on the air during one of our radio programs. That's at drhoffman.com on the homepage. So three ways to get through to us with your questions. And I regret to say, you know, we get questions sometimes on Facebook. We get questions on Twitter. And we can't answer all those questions. Just use one of the three established ways to get questions to us. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the best way. And make your question succinct, please, because otherwise we can't tackle it.
Right. Okay, we've got an email from David. David writes, good day, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. A couple of my friends have a combination of diabetes and compromised kidney function.
Mm-hmm.
If I bring up the topic of controlling their blood glucose levels with diet, they complain that a low-carb diet is necessarily high protein,
mm-hmm.
and as such, verboten for them,
yeah.
having kidney disease.
Yeah.
Of course, the fact that they like their high-carb diet and that their conventional MD tells them to eat that way only makes it more difficult to get them to limit their carb intake. So mm-hmm. the legitimate question is, what is the right diet for an insulin-dependent diabetic with mm-hmm. diminished renal function?
Okay.
Would they have to get most of their calories from oils? Yeah.
Okay, so this is a good question for you to answer because you work with a lot of diabetics. But I'll point out that this is kind of it's kind of between a rock and a hard place situation, because on the one hand, if you eat a lot of protein, that is said to put a burden on your kidneys and hasten kidney deterioration. So if you eschew carbohydrates and mostly eat, say, a lot of meat, then mm-hmm. maybe that's putting a burden on your kidney. On the other hand, if you eat a very, very low protein diet, as they sometimes recommend for people who are heading towards kidney failure, what's left? Well, carbohydrates. So you eat, you have cereal for breakfast, and maybe, you eat some fruit, and you have, some whole grain bread, with, maybe just a slice of lean turkey on it or something. And, you're very sparing about your protein. Well, what fills up that gap is carbohydrates, and that makes your diabetes worse.
Right.
And if your diabetes is poorly controlled, that's going to damage your kidneys. And high blood sugar has a toxic effect on the renal function. So what do you do about that conundrum?
I'll tell you. First of all, for any diabetic, whether type 2, insulin dependent, any of those, we still do want to lower the carbohydrates. The big misconception about a low-carb diet is that it's a high-protein diet. It's not. It's a high-fat diet. And when you couple somebody who has diabetes with compromised kidney function, renal function, we need to make the protein intake more moderate rather than any high at all. Even on a low carb diet, the protein intake is still between 20 and 35%. So for somebody who already has compromised kidney function, we just make sure that that protein is going to hover around 20, 25% rather than the higher at 35%. I'll give you a case study. I have a client in his 70s who probably should have been in dialysis about a year ago, but so far so good. We've been able to keep him away
from dialysis. I haven't seen him, but I recall he came to you right on the cusp of, it was sort of like, can you help keep me from dialysis?
Yeah.
It was right on the cusp.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right on the cusp. What we've been able to do, and he's been diligently following the diet, he has high blood sugar, established diabetes, all of that. We've been able to eradicate that to a good degree with the diet. But then we moderate the protein intake. Instead of having, you know, a 3 or 4 ounce piece of chicken twice a day or steak or something like that, we're going to moderate that down a little bit and maybe even add other quality proteins such as, believe it or not, soy or something like that in the mm-hmm. form of tempeh rather than tofu. Now, this gentleman, if he had also hypothyroidism, I'd have to be careful with that because soy is a big goitrogen.
Right.
What's happened is, and what I've seen in his labs, is his kidney function has actually gotten better by moderating his protein intake. And I want to let everybody know, just because you have compromised renal function, it doesn't mean you go on a no-protein diet. You will not live long.
Yeah.
You need some intake of protein.
So the adverse effects of protein are overrated, perhaps.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Should you be on a high-protein diet? Absolutely not. But you do need some protein.
Mm-hmm.
And even working as a hospital dietitian back in the day, we already know, and I've worked in dialysis in that particular unit, you still need some protein. You still need some protein. Even in end-stage renal failure, protein is not completely verboten. You need some of it. Otherwise, you will fail.
And then when you say, you know, base your diet to some extent on calories from fat, what are those sources?
Exactly. I mean, so what we're talking about is you're not going to have, you know, a 10-ounce steak or something. Maybe you're going to have a smaller steak and add some avocado into your salad, so you're getting some fat calories there.
Olive oil.
Maybe a few nuts and seeds. Olive oil, exactly.
Now, are you completely averse to saturated fat for these people because of their high potential for cardiovascular disease? Because if
you're
type 1 diabetics often succumb to heart attacks and strokes.
Right. And while that has to do with the high blood sugars and the amount of insulin they have to administer to keep that under control.
Mm-hmm.
The high blood sugar and the amount, the units of insulin they have to administer has more to do with that inflammation and moving towards a heart attack and stroke than taking saturated fat. Saturated fat is not a foe. It's not a bad guy at all. Saturated fat is included in a low carb, moderate protein, high fat diet as it should be.
Mm-hmm. And that would provide
a calorie, better. Exactly.
A calorie source and some satiety, which might fend off the yen for carbs.
Right, right.
Okay. Good.
So, yeah. David, thank you for that excellent, excellent question. And there is so much involved in it, and it also has to do with, you know, keeping on top of the labs and seeing where the kidney function is over time as you make the tweaks in diet. But I want to clear this misconception immediately. A low-carb diet is a high-fat diet, not a high-protein diet.
Right.
Okay.
What's next?
All right. David, thank you very much for your question. Let's see here. We've got an email from Mark. This is very interesting. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. After about an hour of sleep, I wake up hungry. This happens almost daily. Sometimes I have a few nuts or a piece of cheese and I go back to sleep. Sometimes I just go back to sleep. If I do go back to sleep without eating, I don't wake up hungry. Do you have any idea why this is? and what I may do to stop it.
Wait, you just said if he goes to bed without eating, he doesn't wake up.
Yeah, sometimes if he just goes back to sleep and ignore his hunger, mm-hmm. he doesn't wake up hungry.
Which paradoxically, in other words, he's hungrier an hour after going to sleep, but in the morning he's not hungry.
Right, right. So, you know, if he wakes up hungry in the middle of the night and has some nuts or a piece of cheese, he goes back to sleep, but he may wake up hungry again, which is a bit of a paradox. I wonder if some of this, besides being blood sugar related, could also have a little bit of food allergy, allergic addiction kind of related as a source of his going back to sleep. Mark, what I would do is make sure that you're having a full good dinner, a good amount of fat and good protein sources in your dinner, along with low glycemic carbohydrate. You may be someone who requires maybe 2 hours before bedtime a little bit of a snack, mm-hmm. but maybe not in the form of nuts or cheese, which a lot of low-carb dieters come to depend on a little too much. And dairy may be problematic with the casomorphins. It's a little bit of a fix. It's a little bit of an opioid fix. And a lot of low-carb dieters go a little crazy with the nuts because nuts kind of take the place of the activity of chips, mm-hmm. possibly becoming the new snack food. What I would do for a 2 hour prior to bedtime snack would be eat the rest of the dinner you didn't finish. You know, the rest of that chicken thigh that you didn't finish nibbling on, or mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. That might be a good idea. Or a hard-boiled egg or something. And if you do wake up in the middle of the night hungry, I would say you may be thirsty. Have a glass of water and go back to sleep mm-hmm. and ignore it.
He did not comment on whether he has any other medical conditions or he takes any medications or if he's overweight.
No.
Anything like that. Because
nothing like that.
That might provide a clue to dysregulated blood sugar.
Right.
And, you know, certainly one can be on a yo-yo pattern of, mm-hmm. High carbohydrate diet followed by reactive hypoglycemia a few hours later.
That's, exactly. You know, exactly. So I'm assuming he may be on a lower carb diet, but maybe not. Hmm. If he's not, and he's just relying on the nuts or the piece of cheese to go back to sleep and waking up hungry again, absolutely could be unstable blood sugar during the night. So, Mark, check your diet. Number two, you may need some chromium. At breakfast and at dinner time, you may need some chromium to help regulate your blood sugar.
So, actually, go ahead.
Yeah. A lot of people who are waking up hungry in the middle of the night, they may be mistaking that hunger for thirst.
Okay.
And I really question that. So I would invite anyone who says they're hungry when apparently they shouldn't be, or it's the wrong time of day to be hungry, have a glass of water and then wait 20 minutes and see how you feel. Mm-hmm. Are you still hungry? Mark may be thirsty in the middle of the night.
As I look it up here, there is a syndrome called night eating syndrome. It says here, night eating syndrome is an eating disorder characterized by a delayed circadian pattern of food intake. It's different than binge eating. It just means that people have a weird increase in appetite that causes them to get up and eat. They're often overweight or obese, which suggests that it's driven by, you know, insulin dysregulation. And to some extent there's a habitual element to this. Okay. May reinforce, a habit of taking a little snack in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And of course that's bad because it generally is associated with socking away extra calories. I mean, one of the secrets to weight loss. I mean, I actually had a patient who came in and says, you know how I lose weight? Because he talked to me about, you know, I've lost a lot of weight various times in my life. I said, well, how do you lose weight? I stop eating after 3 p.m. That never fails. And I'm able to lose weight. So, you know, the opposite is in effect in sumo wrestlers who are instructed to not eat a lot during the daytime, but eat a big, big dinner and keep, you know, eat a lot of white rice, which is great for, you know, putting on the pounds, and then lie down right away. Don't do any exercise whatsoever. Just lie down, go to sleep. know? And that's how you turn into a sumo wrestler.
Right.
Pack away the pounds.
Pack on the fat. And, you know, the other thing is when we're eating in the middle of the night and then going back to sleep, we're not meant to be digesting in the middle of the night. We're meant to be sleeping soundly, and it's not going to work as well if our digestive system has suddenly been summoned to do its job.
Yeah,
you know,
and
it's supposed to be a time of rest.
And there's a reason they call it breakfast. It's a break fast. And you know, intermittent fasting, you know, for some people, the idea of going a couple of days a week without eating is, you know, completely untenable. But deciding not to eat after, say, 8 p.m. at night and having your first meal at 10 or 11, that could work a lot better. And that, in effect, creates intermittent fasting, which does a reset on your body and enables you to sometimes shed pounds. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Mark, thank you for your very interesting, thoughtful question. All right.
We have time for another question if you want to tackle it.
Okay, let's see. We've got an email here. During a recent home inspection, we discovered that the well water was high in arsenic. It was recommended that we... However, I was assured that bathing in the unfiltered water was perfectly acceptable. They claim that arsenic does not penetrate the skin, and the amount absorbed is minimal. I was still uncomfortable with this claim. Do you have any thoughts on this? I wouldn't bathe in it either.
Right.
I'd get a whole house filtration system, not just your drinking water.
Right.
And you know, well water will be high in arsenic because of all pesticide, herbicide residue that goes down into the aquifer.
Right.
The east end of Long Island,
I don't know the statistics or the science of this, but generally, when it comes to absorption through the skin, smaller molecules are more readily absorbed through the skin. And since arsenic exists in its elemental form, which is pretty small, and an oxide form, which is still pretty small, I would worry about the potential for absorption through the skin. I know that industrial workers who work in situations where there's arsenic are told to glove up and wear, you know, protective gear and, you know, certainly have breathing apparatus. And so, I think that the arsenic should be addressed both in the drinking water and in the bath water. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thank you for your question.
And, you know, arsenic, what does arsenic do in the body? You know, besides, you know, arsenic and old lace, you know, the old, murder plot, you know, what does it do to the body? Arsenic poisoning is a medical condition that occurs due to elevated levels of arsenic in the body. And, you know, in a more extreme form, vomiting, abdominal pain, brain changes, watery diarrhea, but the problem is not acute. It's more chronic exposure to relatively not immediately fatal levels, but sort of low level toxicity. They say 200 million people globally are exposed to higher than safe levels of arsenic, and this is actually pretty common, especially in India, in Bangladesh, and West Bengal. Symptoms of arsenic poisoning: headaches, confusion, drowsiness, can be related to heart disease, can damage the heart, can damage the lungs. And it actually can promote diabetes. It increases the risk of cancer. So there's a reason to be concerned, you know, with exposure.
Yeah. And I think with any well water anywhere, you need a whole house filtration system.
And lately, there's been concern that rice is a source of arsenic. Rice grown in the U.S. has an average of 260 parts per billion of arsenic. And paradoxically, China, where we think that things are more polluted, has set an even more rigorous standard for arsenic in food, although it's not clear that that's always adhered to. There's also this arsenic in applesauce thing that Dr. Oz brought up, and that might be more of a concern in young children. So, you know, we tend to think of it as one of those, it's almost like a heavy metal, like lead or cadmium in that category. It may cause vascular endothelial dysfunction, which could lead to, you know, renal problems, blood pressure problems, circulatory problems. So, you know, what's the way to deal with it? Well, first of all, you know, in terms of detecting it, we actually can detect it through tests, hair analysis, but that's actually not legal in many states, including New York. But we can do a blood test, or we can do, better yet, a urine test with a provocation, because DMSA tends to bind to arsenic and pull it out of the body. So it's both a diagnostic. We do a challenge with DMSA. We see if a lot of arsenic comes out. And they also can use DMSA, which is a prescription item, as a way of pulling out the excess arsenic and lead and cadmium in the body, and mercury to some extent. So there you go. You know, historically, I'm reading an article here in Wikipedia. There's have been historical examples of very famous people who were poisoned with arsenic, including perhaps Napoleon Bonaparte, Simon Bolivar, but it might have been just environmental exposure due to contaminated drinking water in Peru that did Simon Bolivar in, the liberator of Latin America, who gave his name to Bolivia. You know. And so there you have it.
There you have it. Get a filtration system.
Yep. Okay. All right, good discussion.
Thank you, everyone, for listening.
My pleasure joining you today, Layla. And once again, please check out all of our podcasts at drhoffman.com. Subscribe to them via iTunes. Visit our Hoffman Center store for great supplements that we personally curate, and thereby guarantee your own health and continue your support for this free source of information. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.